Welcome to the Western Magazine Hour. Stories and articles about the American West. Produced at the Recording Library of West Texas. Your narrator is Jack.
Hi, this is Jack. I'm reading articles from the February-March edition of Cowboys and Indians. The Native Home of Hope by the CNI Editors. His was a voice of sense and beauty crying out in the wilderness. So we make it a habit to check in periodically with the wise writings of the late, great Wallace Stegner. Though he passed 30 years ago, the words of the Dean of Western Writers still ring out from the pages of his works and seem to echo from mountaintop and canyon. "One cannot be pessimistic about the West," he famously wrote in The Sound of Mountain Water. "This is the native home of hope. When it fully learns that cooperation, not rugged individualism, is the quality that most characterizes and preserves it, then it will have achieved itself and outlived its origins." Stegner's words evoke the wonder of the West and inspired not only the direction of our annual visions of the West Photo Contest, but this entire issue, which is dedicated to American icons that figure prominently in Western life. From singer-songwriter Chris Stapleton's growing stature in the pantheon of American country music, to the ordinary craft of beading, exemplified by Crow designer Brocade Stops Black Eagle, to the undisputed legacy of Pulitzer Prize-winning author Larry McMurtry's Lonesome Dove, which celebrates the 35th anniversary of the adapted miniseries this year. The icons we feature represent the work of many people, not just one person, to achieve greatness. Throughout each story, themes of collaboration and cooperation ring true, for better or worse. The establishment of the American Quarter Horse Association in 1940, now the largest breed association in the world, was the result of a group of breeders and owners coming together in the name of the horses they loved. In the case of Olympic great Jim Thorpe, the famous 20th century athlete from Sac and Fox Nation in present-day Oklahoma, biographer David Moranis illustrates what can happen when an institution fails to support one of its own. Stegner fiercely loved the West and all of the wild, and he fiercely desired to protect it. We feel similarly at CNI and care deeply about what we publish in each issue. It takes a village to produce and perfect each page, and we approach our work hopeful that our collective efforts will preserve the legacy of this publication and the Western lifestyle it represents. Beautiful Beader. Bead by bead, piece by piece, the work of Crow designer Brocade Stops Black Eagle is a labor of love, as told to Erica Haight. Brocade Stops Black Eagle, Crow, Mandan, Hidatsa, is a busy woman. Wife, mother, trail runner, and businesswoman, she was born and raised on the Crow Indian Reservation and worked as a registered nurse in her native community of Crow Agency, Montana, for more than a decade. An outdoor enthusiast, she's a mountain ultra-trail runner who has completed several ultra-marathons. She also runs her own ready-to-wear company, whose pieces are inspired by old Crow geometric designs and color palettes that reflect her beadwork and lifestyle. She learned beading from her mother, a seamstress, at a young age and has been honing her craft for over 30 years. Now a master beater, she creates one-of-a-kind regalia for her family and the horses they ride when they parade. At any given time, she might be working on martingales, bridles, keyhole ornaments, old-time saddles, and more. Photographer Erica Haight traveled to Crow Agency, where Brocade lives with her husband and three sons, to photograph her and her work and talk about beading, parading, and their significance in Crow culture. With snow on the ground and the family assisting with loading while she gathered her belongings, we did the interview at her house and then trailered the horses about a mile or so to the banks of the Little Bighorn River for our shoot. Haight says, "I am amazed every time I am witness to such an event. It's like a masterpiece being created right before your eyes. The care, time, and incredible details that go into fitting their loved ones. Each individual piece is meticulously layered on both horse and rider." We invite you to share in the masterpiece through Haight's photographs and Brocade's words. "My mom saw a story in Vogue magazine. I think it was an article about a lady whose name was Brocade, and my mom loved that. She loved sewing, and she loved Brocade fabric, and she was like, 'I never thought of naming someone after fabric.'" We see beadwork everywhere. Crow Fair, dances, the parade. I love the parade. Just seeing everyone on their horses all decked out, looking beautiful in their beadery. I just love it. So beading has always been around. I learned as a kid. I would stay in during the summers with my grandmother. First, she would clean her house, and then she'd sit there and have her coffee, and then she would bead. I'm not like that. I don't clean my house first, but I had that exposure. You're running around in the morning, you go outside, it gets hot, you're back in, and she's still sitting there beading. I'd sit there and watch her and was really interested in it. I would ask her questions. What size needles? What thread? What are you working on? That exposure really helped. Then, when my sister wanted to parade and dance, we started with nothing. Me and my mother were like, "You know, we don't got anything. We don't want to bother anyone. We just do it ourselves." So my mom was all in on it. We asked community members how to bead stuff, and they would share how they did it. Then we just figured it out ourselves. What really speaks to me is the old Crow designs. That's what I love. I love the shapes they use, the colors, how they outlined everything in white or navy blue. I've also seen that dark forest green color they outlined stuff with, too. I just liked how they used the patterns and the colors to really make the design. What's the word I'm looking for? Make the design pop. My mother always said to do too light and too dark, and then put a light and a dark against each other. And that really makes the design come out. So I really always remember that and try to choose too dark and too light. And then I sit and I'll put my needles down and I'm just like, I'm going to try this and try this. Sometimes it doesn't look good and I'll take it out and start over because I think about something else that'll make it look better. Sometimes I'll go for a run and designs come to me. They've come in my dreams. For instance, my husband's parade outfit. I had a dream about it. As soon as I woke up, I drew it. And then I was like, you know, that's a special design. I'm going to do it for my husband. The number one question I get every time is, how long did it take you? I don't time it. I think the only thing I've actually really timed was making my husband's fully beaded vest, and that took me about a month. But that was sitting down 12 hours a day. Yeah, from sunup to sundown. I would not leave that couch. I'd watch TV. I was sitting there forever. But I got it done. Right now, the couch is clean compared to what it usually is. Usually there's threads and needles and everything over there. When people sit down, I'm like, don't touch that. You're going to get stabbed. It's going to stab you. It's going to stab you. So they know now, and they're like, don't mess with Mom's area. Except for the cat. He loves going around there. He hasn't learned yet. He just jumps around stuff. But they know not to sit there. That's my area. I beaded a cradle board for each one of my three sons. I started after I found out I was pregnant and got their cradle board done by the time they were about 6 months old. I love cradle boards. Cradle boards are my favorite item to bead. You can mix and match your designs and do whatever you want, which is why, as a designer, I like them. You don't have to get tired of beading the same thing over and over because you can just do so many different things. Then, when you see your baby in there, honestly, the babies love it. I put my kids in there and I'm like, okay, we get a photo shoot. And you're like, oh man, we got to wrap them up and stick them in there and we got to go get a photo right there. Hurry up, hurry up. But my kids just loved it. They would be so happy just looking around, and they would even fall asleep. It's amazing how they just loved it. I love that because it's the beginning of their life, and you get a picture, and that's really important to me. We call it the old-time saddle. The old-time saddle has those pretty big horns on each side. There are many key pieces. We bead the top of the saddle, and two ornaments hang down from it. We also bead a part off on the stirrups. At the front, there's the keyhole ornament, which goes on the forehead of the horse. We bead the reins, which you connect to the keyhole, and then you tie it around the neck, right on the nose. At the front of the horse is the martingale, or breast collar. On the front, the cradle board hangs from the right side, and the purse, or a shield, is on the left. At the back, the war bonnet case hangs on the left, and the lance case is on the right. In the back, tied to the bottom of the back horn, buckskin saddlebags and rawhide saddlebags hang on both sides. There's a crupper at the rump of the horse that loops under the tail to keep the saddle from slipping forward. There's a saddle blanket, and you sit on mountain lion hide. I was actually able to go to the Autry Museum last year and look at beadwork there, which was really special. I came to the conclusion that beadwork is the way that we showed our love for our people. Even now I'll hear it. When somebody goes by and they see someone all in their beadwork, they're like, that person's really loved. I've heard that several times. When we were roaming the plains, think about all the work women did. They did everything. They put up the teepee. They cooked. They raised their kids while our men were out hunting and going to war and protecting us. They did everything. Just think about the time that they took away from all of that to do all this beadwork. Back then, they didn't even have all the amenities that we have now, like an air conditioner, TV, even just a comfortable couch.
Championship arenas.
I've seen pictures where they'd be outside just sitting on the ground beading.
She backs really her cool. bay gelding
so that's
into
what
the
it means
corner
to
of
me.
The roping box.
It shows the love
the buzz
I have
of arena
for my
lights
family.
Overhead,
I love
while cowgirls with
stuff.
Long braids and
I don't
quiet
know what
horses
it is. I can't
crowd her peripheral.
It's just a sense of pride.
She feels her rope coils in her left hand
like
and the weight of the loop in her right. She takes a deep breath and nods. A cream-colored calf emerges from the chute directly in front of her. She hangs in the balance for a brief moment to ensure she doesn't break the barrier, and then, with the slightest shift, she asks her horse to move. He rocks back on his massive hindquarters and propels himself forward from a standstill to a gallop instantaneously. She swings her rope, releases it, and it lands smoothly around the calf's neck. A tidy bell collar catch. She stops her horse. He slides to his haunches. The rope is taut and then intentionally breaks from the horn. The calf lopes off and the timer is stopped. In a matter of seconds, Andrea Lean has finished her breakaway run at the world's richest roping event in Guthrie, Oklahoma. Lean, a tall blonde in a pecan felt hat, is a 33-year-old amateur rider who traveled to the event with her best friend, fellow roper Cora Corrigan. The two have been riding together since they were children in rural Minnesota, roping hay bales in the barn aisle during the frigid Midwestern winter. Whenever you rope that first hay bale or that first calf, it lights a fire under you and it captivates you, Leon says. At first, you don't think it seems possible or that you can be successful roping. But then you rope it one time, two times, four times, 100 times. You just never stop. Breakaway roping, a timed event in which a rider ropes a calf that breaks away after the rope becomes taut, is one of the fastest growing women's rodeo events in the nation. Lean represents a growing sector of women devoting their free time and resources to pursue a roping career. Living in remote southern Illinois on her partner's rodeo rough stock operation, she splits her time between her in-town job as an ultrasound tech and her life on the rodeo circuit. Many of the people I know who are competing are nurses, coaches, or teachers. Just regular people you wouldn't know could go out and rope a calf in 1.9 seconds. It's really cool. With the creation of the Women's Professional Rodeo Association, formerly Girls Rodeo Association, in 1948, it's now the longest-standing female sports organization in the country. Women have been roping professionally for more than 75 years. But roping popularity and financial incentives have grown tremendously in the past decade. National Finals Breakaway Roping was established in 2020. And the American Rodeo added breakaway roping in 2019. In 2019, there were 30 PRCA-sanctioned breakaway roping events. In 2023, there were more than 450. Women's roping hasn't been limited to competitions. For centuries, women have been working and riding alongside their male counterparts. Though rarely hired as hands, cowgirls were born into ranching families and expected to have the skill set to start colts, rope livestock, and assist in brandings. These skills were born on the open range of the 19th century and fostered in the arenas of the 20th century. With the popularity of Western-themed entertainment like Buffalo Bill's Wild West Show, whose 1893 show reportedly had 3 million spectators, rodeo was in its renaissance, and women were competing. In the 1920s, one-third of all rodeos had events for women, often including rough stock and roping. Accessibility took a hit after a series of high-profile female bronc riders were either injured or killed while competing. Most notable was Bonnie McCarroll, who tragically died from injuries sustained during her intended retirement bronc ride in 1929. After her highly publicized death, women's roughneck events, as well as roping, were removed from the majority of mainstream rodeos. By the 1930s, women were celebrated more for their aesthetics than athleticism. Traditional gender roles were encouraged, and rodeo queen pageants became common in the 1940s. The early pioneers of the WPRA advocated for greater opportunities and pay for professional female athletes. These skilled ranch women promoted bronc riding, barrel racing, and roping. Though tie-down roping was a WPRA event in 1948, breakaway roping was not featured until 1974.
it became an annual event in 1989, steadily increasing in consecutive years. Professional female ropers began getting noticed, like Betty Gale, Pam Ratliff, and Pam Minnick of the 1970s and 1980s, Larry DeGuy from the early 2000s to today, and current top prospect Jackie Crawford. Crawford has a well-earned following, not only because of her athletic talent, but also for her ability to balance a family and a highly competitive roping career. The now 41-year-old mother famously won the inaugural Wrangler National Finals of breakaway roping 6 months pregnant. It was her 20th WPRA world title. She has provided a framework and been an inspiration for countless riders navigating motherhood and a career. For professional breakaway roper Addie Hill, a 27-year-old new mother who operates a boutique alongside riding client horses, the community aspect of rodeo has been a welcome respite. I was always told, just take your babies with you. You don't need to change your lifestyle, just take them with you. It's very normal to see kids at all the rodeos with their parents competing. That's helped me a ton as a new mom. People are there to support you. It's really cool to be a part of that. Historically, rodeo and ranching culture has had a familial energy. It isn't uncommon to have multiple generations of families competing and riding together. An easy example of this phenomenon is the legendary Saddle Bronc family, the Wrights, with 9 relatives simultaneously participating in the same circuit. This element of fellowship has roots at working ranches with neighbors, including children and elders, gathering together at brandings to rope, brand, vaccinate, and castrate stock. Rodeo events like breakaway roping have a clear lineage to practical ranching skills. Its popularity represents a clear message. Often, the best hands are women. Lean, the amateur rider with big dreams, looks to her mentors in the sport for her own inspiration. Breakaway ropers are the typical image of what you think of when you think of a cowgirl. Very warm, very welcoming. But they're tough and rough, and they could probably beat you up. But they're just as beautiful as the freaking rodeo queens. They're what I've always envisioned as the all-around cowgirl. The Russells in Denver. More than 100 years after Old West icon C.M. Russell and wife Nancy visited the Mile High City for a solo show, a new exhibition celebrates their stay. By Mark Bedore. Nearly a century after his death, there are still few discoveries to be made and stories to be told from the prolific life of legendary Western artist Charlie Russell and his beloved and indispensable wife, Nancy. The Russells in Denver, 1921, a brand new exhibit at the Denver Art Museum, reveals the until now overlooked story of Charlie's 2-week solo show and sale of new paintings and sculptures at the city's historic and still prestigious Brown Palace Hotel. Spotlighting 18 paintings and sculptures, the exhibit and its accompanying catalog emphasize the critical role Nancy played in her famous husband's success. There would have been no Charlie, the internationally famous artist, without Nancy, says 1921 curator J.R. Hinneman. Nancy was Charlie's business manager, public relations agent, and inspiration. The best booster and partner a man ever had, the grateful husband once said. She could convince anybody I was the greatest artist in the world. You can't disappoint a person like that, so I did my best work for her. whether it was booking shows, making travel arrangements, or setting up interviews, Nancy loved the part she played. It was a joy to supply his needs, she wrote, and do the things he could not do without disturbing his creative genius. Initially inspired by Russell scholar Brian W. Dippy and Russell collector Tom Petrie, the 1921 exhibition has been in the works for years, with Hinneman leading a vast team of specialists working on the project. Together, they've unearthed fascinating details that offer a window onto the world of 1921 Denver, a bustling city with a thriving art community, proud of its Western roots. Charlie and Nancy fit right in. Married by then for 25 years, the couple operated like a well-oiled machine. Nancy made sure her husband's show was in all the papers. She also handled sales, and Charlie was at his creative peak. They had certainly figured out their team dynamic, Hinneman says. Whether portraying the rough-and-tumble life of an 1880s cowboy or an Indian tribe on the move, Russell's work here shows the sensitive authenticity that is a hallmark of everything he created. Gathered from a variety of sources, the 1921 collection includes works from both the 1921 show plus earlier paintings with similar subjects, revealing dramatic improvements in Russell's work. By 1921, he had spent decades honing his technique and understanding of color and composition. These comparisons underscore how much Russell had matured in his technique and understanding of color and composition. The paintings and sculptures are among some of Charlie's most accomplished. The show includes 7 bronze works. We see Russell's humor and knowledge of cowboy life in his sculptures, she says. Consider the humorous Weapons of the Week, in which a porcupine has treed a family of bears, and the dramatic When the Best of Riders Quit, where a rider appears ready to bail off his backwards falling steed. The show even includes an original copy of Good Medicine, a collection of Charlie's illustrated letters published posthumously by Nancy and signed with notes from Charlie's many friends. Delayed by the pandemic from its planned 2021 opening, 1921, like all of Russell's work, remains timelessly captivating. And even after 100 years, the stories he told in his work remain fresh and the story of his life with Nancy revelatory. People are drawn to Charlie's storytelling in paint, bronze, and text, Hinneman says. His paintings and sculptures are beautiful, dynamic, and engaging. No wonder they continue to stand the test of time. South Dakota's Dignity of Earth and Sky. Dale Claude Lamphere's tribute to Native peoples also celebrates the beauty of the Great Plains. By Lance Nixon. She stands with her back to the wind and her face to the morning sun, and the diamonds in the star quilt she has wrapped around her shine like pieces of the night sky. She is Dignity of Earth and Sky, sculptor Dale Claude Lamphere's celebration of Dakota and Lakota women and the plains world they inhabit. The 50-foot-tall sculpture of fabricated stainless steel stands just off Interstate 90 on the east bluff of the Missouri River near Chamberlain, South Dakota, the very heart of one of the two states named for the Dakota and Lakota people. A gentleman came to me and wanted to do something to acknowledge the Native nations we have here in South Dakota, says Lamphere, who has a studio at the edge of the Black Hills near Sturgis, South Dakota. He wanted it to be Native and a woman. Beyond that, there were no instructions. Lamphere, who is white, was hesitant. Appointed South Dakota Artist Laureate in 2015, a post formerly held by the late great Dakota artist Oscar Howe. He has been criticized when he has occasionally done pieces that feature Native people. Lakota artist Dwayne Wilcox, who is also a South Dakotan, says Lamphere is a talented artist, bar none. But, he says, creating monumental pieces on behalf of Native Americans seems to satisfy South Dakota's need to acknowledge Native Americans while letting the mainstream culture handle the memory. This is a hot topic in the South Dakota Native art world for the simple fact we don't have that kind of skill or finance to sculpt such a large-scale project, Wilcox says. I don't see a project of this magnitude ever being offered to us because of the financial burden it would bring to the artist. Lamphere acknowledges there's a dilemma. There's a movement today, and rightly so, that Native artwork ought to be done by Native people, he says. But then he thought about what could be done if he accepted the commission. As I began exploring the subject, I realized the design possibilities of a star quilt were really exciting. A star quilt is a very important symbolic element in their culture. When a child is born, they wrap them in a star quilt, with the understanding that they have come down from the stars, and so the star quilt makes them feel more at home. And as they go on in life, whenever there's a significant accomplishment, they give them a star quilt to honor that occasion. So he began to draw using the star quilt. Then I contacted a Lakota friend of mine and wrapped her in a star quilt and went out on a windy day and began to design the sculpture. After 5 or 6 drawings, Lamphere moved on to a small clay maquette and then eventually to a larger clay maquette. It was 5 feet tall, and the ultimate work is 50 feet tall, so it made an easy translation. The finished sculpture weighs 12 tons. It's made of hundreds of pieces of stainless steel, including 128 diamonds for the quilt. He ended up using 3 Native women for models, one in her 50s, one at the threshold of her 30s, and one a teenager. I didn't want to represent any one Native person, but rather distill the essential characteristics and elements of their countenance and movement. He also contemplated the location and placement. I always consider the environment when working on these large-scale works. In our Great Plains region, the prevailing wind is from the northwest, so I placed the back of the piece to that direction. I like to show as much interaction and integration with the environment as possible, so the dress is windswept and the wind and sun can move through the piece. The diamonds are offset and there's a slight bit of movement to them, so it's really part of the environment. As I came to consider what colors to use in the star quilt, I picked up the colors of the water and the sky that are immediately adjacent to the piece. Lamphere suggests the name of the piece has a lot to do with the sweeping expanse of land and sky and the great river of the plains that provide the context here on the east bluff of the Missouri. Initially, the working title was Of Earth and Sky. It was something rooted to the earth and yet of the waters, of the sky. But then the Dignity name was mentioned by the donor and it stuck. It seems to me to speak more fully of the real wholeness and beauty of the Great Plains area. There is a dignity to the earth and the sky in this area that's hard to miss. Lamphere, now 76, grew up in the ranch country of western South Dakota and has always paid attention to the land in his art. The common element that runs through my work is the lyric line that I see in the mountain and prairie environment and the intersection of prairie to mountain and the grasses, the flora of our Great Plains area. The wind is always blowing to some degree, so I study the movement of the grasses and the structure of them. These inform my work. Their every piece is moving in some way, has a gesture to it, a sweep to it. Those are largely just echoing the environment in which I live. Work on Dignity of Earth and Sky began in 2014, and the piece was dedicated in September 2016. After a 53-year career making more than 60 large-scale pieces, life-size or bigger, Lamphere says Dignity has generated the greatest response by far. I've received more positive feedback on this sculpture than on any other work, he says, and that includes an audience he's particularly eager to please. I've been fortunate that it's been very well received by Native communities. I've heard it referred to as the Statue of Liberty for Native people. Even visitors from other countries are taking note. Peter Zsolt Fekete, a native of Hungary who worked for a time as a researcher at South Dakota State University some years ago, saw the Dignity sculpture when he revisited the state in 2018. When we stopped, it was near to evening time, Fekete says. It was a late sunset, and the colors were amazing on this robe that she was wearing. Noting South Dakota's history of conflict with Native Americans, it was the site of the infamous Wounded Knee Massacre of December 1890, for instance. Fekete says seeing Dignity was a positive surprise. For Lamphere's part, a non-Native artisan can only try to grapple with the West's history of conflict, the kind of oppression that the Native communities have felt over the decades. It's been a very difficult thing, he says. I don't think we as white people really understand the generational trauma they've gone through. I tried to be empathetic to that. Caitlin Svensson of Travel South Dakota says tourists and state residents alike have been struck by the elegance of the piece since it first took its place beside Interstate 90. Certainly since the installation, it has grown in popularity and has become a notable icon for South Dakota. As of July 2017, South Dakotans can even opt for a license plate design that features Dignity instead of the usual Mount Rushmore. Though there are parts of the piece he might have liked to work on longer, Lamphere believes Dignity succeeded in ways that are not solely to do with the artist. In a sense, I try to get out of the way. I try to be a human mechanism to make the sculpture manifest itself. If it's a human form, I try to enter into the spirit of what I'm trying to create. For Lamphere, the best creative activity is when the artist just becomes a conduit for something that needs to be said, something that wants to come out. My intent, Lamphere says, is for the sculpture to stand as an enduring symbol of our shared belief that all here are sacred and in a sacred place. Horse of Dreams. American quarter horses continue to win people over with their willing minds, mighty hearts, and great beauty. By Larry Joe Starkey. If there's one thing all American quarter horses have in common, it's a willing spirit. Well, make that a willing spirit and owners willing to brag until the cows come home about their amazing horses. Quarter horse owners tend to have a tenacious streak that has made the American Quarter Horse Association the largest single breed horse registry in the world, not just the United States. They are loyal to their chosen breed, and for good reason. Back in the 1940s, when AQHA was young, cattle producers and race enthusiasts were feuding over what exactly was the best kind of quarter horse. The so-called bulldog men wanted a stout body built to go all day for ranch work, while the racers wanted a sleek greyhound body built for speed. After a few years of squabbling, the compromise the founders reached was simple. You do you, and I'll do me. You build your dreams, and I'll build mine. Breeders have long focused on the best horses that can make their individual dreams come true, and the result is a horse that can make anyone's dreams come true. It's not hyperbole. Literal dreams have come through quarter horses. Quarter horses are bigger than humans, but they're primarily prey animals. The best of them have overcome their flight instincts to trust humans to stand near them and pat them on their solid, short-haired bodies that smell of warm grass and sunshine. Their bravery has been cultivated through the years. Our horse evolved from the horses brought to America by the colonials and the Spanish, and the horse that came to be the American quarter horse was destined to be our partner in work and transportation. Heavily muscled, fast, and good-minded, says Chris Stitz, chief foundation officer of the American Quarter Horse Foundation, which operates the American Quarter Horse Hall of Fame and Museum in Amarillo, Texas. They were the rancher's partner, the go-to horse for the cowboy because they don't give up, cover rough terrain, and don't let you down. In 1940, ranchers gathered in Fort Worth, Texas to discuss a horse registry for the kind of horses they liked. The kind of horse that made their cowboying jobs easier, not harder. The ranchers agreed that the horse that stood grand champion at the Southwestern Exposition and Fat Stock Show would be given the first registration number. Wimpy, owned by the venerable King Ranch, won and received that number. After that, the registry exploded as more and more owners wanted their favorite horses to be not just ranch horses, but quarter horses. That affinity for the brand grew in exciting ways as the association created a magazine, the American Quarter Horse Journal, so that breeders could advertise their horses to one another. A youth organization followed, then a youth world show. Then the AQHA World Championship Show in 1972. The All-American Futurity, a race strictly for two-year-old quarter horses, was first run in 1959. In 1978, the All-American became the first race in history to offer a $1 million purse. It's still the richest race in North America, regardless of the breed, with a purse of $3 million. These advancements were intended to keep up with the consumer demand for quarter horses. In 1992, AQHA established the Best Remuda Award to recognize the contributions of the great ranches that breed using horses, the kind that last all day under a hot sun trailing a herd of cattle. In fact, the quarter horse has become so synonymous with ranching an American westward expansion that many people think only of ranches when thinking of quarter horses. The breed, however, got its name from the horse's ability to run a quarter of a mile faster than any other horse. Short-distance match racings began during colonial times. On bush tracks in rural parts of America, those match races continue today. Quarter horse racing is the kind of sport that appeals to people who don't want to wait more than 23 seconds to know which horse won. In fact, an early definition of the quarter horse was a horse that could run a quarter mile in less than 23 seconds. During the 2023 All-American Futurity, the world's richest quarter horse race, offering that purse of $3 million, Cowboys Gun Z ran the classic quarter-mile distance in 21.574 seconds to win, making his owners very happy people indeed. Those racing dreams have been shared by thousands. In the 1950s, Oscar June Jeffers and his wife Zelma dreamed of breeding a racing quarter horse that would win a lot of money. They bred their best mare to the best stallion they could afford. Mr. Barnum was foaled in 1955. The dark chestnut stallion was gentle enough that amateur June Jeffers could ride him around the block in Wagoner, Oklahoma, explosive enough to burst out of the starting gates, and determined enough to beat his competition to the finish line. He was a champion, and he sired champions. June and Zelma Jeffers' grandchildren can still talk about the dreams that single horse made come to life. Mr. Barnum was inducted into the American Quarter Horse Hall of Fame in 2014, the highest honor possible for people and horses through the AQHA. Of the more than 6 million quarter horses registered, only 138 have been inducted. Here's a bigger honor. Across the United States, right this minute, young girls with barrel racing dreams are braiding the manes of horses descended from Mr. Barnum, adorning those horses' bodies with brightly colored tack and fringe before riding them in gymkhanas and rodeos. Those girls are learning horsemanship, sportsmanship, responsibility, and compassion from horses with liquid eyes and powerful haunches. Our quarter horse family is connected by an unwavering admiration for our horse, Sitz says. This love for the breed, their minds, hearts, beauty, and the partnerships we're lucky enough to share with them, is the foundation for our forever friendships and families. In 2019, three athletes from Texas competed at the Special Olympics in Abu Dhabi, the capital of the United Arab Emirates. One of them, Spencer Robertson, swept gold in every equestrian discipline. Back home in Texas, Spencer rides quarter horses that have been donated to the Stable Strides Farm in Pilot Point through a program to teach independence in life through independence in riding. Quarter horses are so mellow and good-minded, says Mandy Cleveland, program director at Stable Strides. They don't startle easily because of their good brains. Much of the equipment around people with special needs can be frightening to horses. Quarter horses, like the program's Amigo, take it in their stride, so to speak. Amigo isn't upset by the power chair one of our clients uses or the robotic arm, Cleveland says. He seems to accept it like, okay, wheels and legs are the same thing. Without prompting, Amigo allows a child in a power chair to lead him. He reaches down his head to greet guests and happily jumps small cross rails with more experienced riders. In a former life, Amigo was a world champion known as One Hot Amigo. In his retirement, he makes dreams come true for people who didn't know their dreams could include quarter horses. The American Quarter Horse is perfectly equipped with the mind to do everything. They are the Labrador Retriever of horse breeds, kind, tolerant, loving, and loyal. The willing mind that the AQHA founders insisted on it is the reason quarter horses have gone beyond their ranching and racing roots to find success in every discipline, from jumping to reining to cowboy mounted shooting. The AQHA World Championship Show, held each October and November in Oklahoma City, boasted more than 7,800 entries and 1,356 exhibitors vying for titles in four divisions in 2023. The top classes included trail, ranch trail, and healing and roping. American quarter horses are now our partners in competition, recreation, therapy, education, and so much more, Sitz says. I believe we are only in the middle of the story, and the American Quarter Horse will continue to evolve as our partner. The ranching and racing founders of the AQHA wouldn't have recognized all the ways quarter horses would be expected to serve, but they would be proud. Their first requirement was a horse they could use and a body stout enough to carry dreams. Above board. Designer Rush Jenkins wasn't at all stumped when tasked with transforming a humble log cabin into a hoe home by Laura Castelny. Survival certainly trumped style back in the 1630s when the Finns and Swedes began building some of the United States' earliest log cabins in New Sweden, today's Delaware, New Jersey, and parts of Pennsylvania. Sure, there were open floor plans, but only because the houses comprised a single room. Low ceilings, few windows, and even fewer amenities didn't exactly make them fit for entertaining. But they were easy to build. A single person could construct a cabin in a week or two, and they lasted for generations. In fact, the clever notched construction has made the homes ripe for restoration and renovation. And over the last century or so, the words luxury and log cabin have become synonymous in mountain resort towns like Big Sky, Beaver Creek, and Jackson Hole. Take the Jackson cabin that once belonged to Clifford Hansen, a prominent rancher, 1960s Wyoming governor, and U.S. senator. While Hansen's contributions have been enshrined by the Hall of Great Westerners at the National Cowboy and Western Heritage Museum, his former ranch house has seen better days by the late aughts. It was dark and dated, and everything from the electrical and plumbing to the appliances and finishes needed to be rehabbed or replaced. It was up to a New York City transplant to turn things around. After falling in love with a Wyoming cowboy, she also fell in love with the cowboy state. When the couple found an idyllic 40-acre property and old-school cabin, she knew it had the potential to become a dream home where they could raise their growing family. To that end, she recruited Berlin Architects and a former colleague, award-winning Jackson Hole-based designer Rush Jenkins of WJR Design Associates. I knew this client from back when I worked at Sotheby's in New York City, when she worked in American paintings, explains Jenkins. We both have an appreciation for art, architecture, and decorative arts, so that led to an immediate bond and understanding of a shared vision for this project. It's a great pleasure to work with someone who has the same background and reference points, as well as a shared love for the West and Jackson Hole specifically. From the start, client and designer agreed that moves to create something extraordinary shouldn't come at the cost of all the home's original charm and character. The challenge is finding ways to make an old structure new without losing its integrity, says Jenkins. When we update these log cabins that have been built anywhere from the 1960s through the 1990s, whether it's with steel or bronze windows or new technology, appliances, lighting systems, AV, and mechanical systems, we have to do it with a lot of thought and intention. The same care was extended to the footprint, which the architect expanded from 6,800 square feet to 7,500 in order to make way for modern-day must-haves like a butler's pantry, laundry room, and powder bath. and while an existing wing had to go, a new one was built to house the sleeping quarters, including a supremely serene primary suite. It's a luxurious place of respite where they can relax and experience a sense of privacy, Jenkins says. Because the fireplace was too contemporary, he brought in new stone that better fit the architecture. He then built in a cocoon-like feel with felt wallpaper on the walls and a custom headboard upholstered in a damask fabric by Laurel Piana. A homegrown buffalo rug was added for good measure. One of our designers is from Wyoming, and this hide is from their ranch, he says. The primary bathroom called for a little extra bling, starting with the floor-to-ceiling marble walls. We sourced 24 slabs from around the country, which was the exact amount needed for the space. There was no room for error, the designer says. The veins of the marble walls inspired the color of the limestone floors, copper fixtures, and freestanding tub sourced from England. It was fun to take all this gorgeous marble and create a whole room around it with colors that create this sense of calm, Jenkins adds. The existing kitchen had to be totally reconfigured for reasons both practical and pretty. The architecture had to get right. The flow was all wrong. The entrances were wrong. And the focus needed to move to a beautiful picture window that offered a front row seat to the incredible creeks on the land. It was all about reducing the mullions and opening up those views, says Jenkins. Once that was accomplished, Shaker-style oak cabinets were installed and topped with Cristallo quartzite counters. The quartzite really brightened the space. We even chiseled the countertop edges along the island to make it feel a little more rustic. Bronze details, including the hardware and custom oven hood, as well as Miel appliances and suspended steel and brass lighting, add splendor without minimizing the appeal of all the barn wood and peaked ceiling. While the original floors were replaced throughout, with oak and plaster added to some of the walls and ceilings to lighten up the space, it was also important to the designer to salvage the existing discolored logs. Staining wood is unpredictable. Every wood takes it differently. In order to get rid of the logs' yellow and orange tones, we used a walnut color glaze. There's still a bit of an undertone of the yellow, but it works with the warmth of with brown. When it came to choosing an overall palette and specific fabrics and furnishings, Jenkins took his cues from the idyllic landscape, which was much more visible thanks to a new array of windows. What I'm most happy about is that we were inspired by the surroundings and we were able to incorporate the colors inside. The interiors are in harmony with nature, he says. We created peace, tranquility, and a real sense of zen because you're enveloped by these views. We managed to mix antiques and art with cashmere, wood, fur, and other natural materials that are true to the environment. It's a great representation of all the things that I especially love.
Thank you for joining us for the Western Magazine Hour. Stories and articles about the American West. Your narrator has been Jack. You can hear this program on Recording Library of West Texas Radio and on demand with your computer or favorite mobile device at recordinglibrary.org.